November the 30th, 2006, and we are visiting with Eugene Phoney. And Eugene, I know in talking with you that you mentioned that you actually came to Houston in the mid-70s. And so my first question would be, what were you doing in the 50s, 60s, and how did you happen to come to Houston, Texas?
Well, in the 50s, I was just being born. So that was a big step. And I suppose if we fast forward to the 70s, what brought me to Houston was a pursuit of a graduate degree. And so I came to Texas Southern to pursue an MBA. And in the process of making a decision about Texas in terms of coming here, I was walking down the street in Chicago and looked into a window of a small shop owner whose name was Calvin DeAntonac and owned a place called the Woodshop that made cabinets and furniture for a lot of Chicago's middle class. And but in the front of his space, he had a little gallery, and I saw a picture in the window, and went in and engaged him about what the cost was and my interest in the picture, and we kind of went back and forth, and he told me it was $15, of which I thought was an incredibly high price to be charging for something of that nature. And I left, but I couldn't get the picture out of my mind. And a couple of days later, I came back. We continued our conversation, and I told him about what I was getting ready to do. I ended up putting the picture in layaway and purchasing it, and kind of started a relationship. And he, at that particular point, told me that if I was coming to Texas, that he had some materials, small reproductions, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, other people of that stature, said that people in Texas had probably never seen, and that I could probably make book money while I was pursuing my degree. So I came to Houston with an armful of pictures under my arm, and first person I met over at Texas Southern was a Professor Ron Bearden, who had been hired by the university to beef up their accreditation program. And so me and Ron became friends at the university. And I was his student assistant for a period throughout the program. Well, while the program was going on, I was selling these pictures on the side, and different people kind of started coming to me as an authority on how to get different pieces of art. Of course, this was not my background, so if somebody asked me for a Van Gogh Starry Night, my first thought process was simply how to get it. And I would end up going over to the Museum of Fine Arts, researching in their bookstores and gift shops, and I'd find a Van Gogh Starry Night, bring it back, sell it to the client, and everyone was terribly happy. What ended up happening was an old friend of mine in Chicago got a purchase order to put together about a 40-piece art collection for the city of Chicago, one of their branch libraries. And in there were a number of notable African-American names, Jacob Lawrence, Romare Bearden, John Biggers. And she asked me, did I think I had the capabilities of putting this collection together? And there again, not really having any knowledge of how prominent these artists were, my first inclination was no problem. So I went to the library. This is maybe about a year after I've gotten here, so this is 77. And I got a book, Bibliographies of African-American Artists, and start going through the list, and of course I came to John Bigger's name, who had a lot of material by his name, and I looked and said, huh, he's at Texas Southern. I'm in the School of Business, which is at the far end of the campus, and the art department is on the opposite end of the campus, so there had never been any engagement between me and him, other than I had seen some of the murals on the walls. And so John Biggers was my first person. I asked around the campus, and they said, yeah, he's the professor over on the other side of campus. And they told me a couple of things, so I got myself together and went over and introduced myself to him and told him about the project that I was getting ready to do. And so he said, no problem, that sure, that I could buy a couple of pieces from him and pay him down the line. So he brought out a couple of works, and I looked at them, and okay, these are very good. But he seemed to have a perception, and he looked at me, and he went back and brought out a lithograph from the 50s entitled Cotton Pickers. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting because as soon as I saw that picture, I got that same feeling all over again that I got when I first saw that beginning picture that had brought me into this whole program. So we kind of cut the deal, and I was looking at it and feeling very good about the piece. And then I looked at it, and upon close examination, I saw a little small triangular hole in that was kind of embedded in a piece of cotton. And so, of course, some of the books that I'd been reading had kind of indicated that prints and artwork needed to be in pristine condition and kept in antiseptic drawers. And so I kind of queried Dr. Biggers about this. And he looked at him, looked me in the eye, and says, well, you know, he says, I only did 10 of those, he said, and that was where a worm ate through the whole edition. He says, I think that probably makes it worth more money. It sounded...
The artistic worm.
It sounded totally plausible to me, and of course I was feeling so good about the picture that, hey, I bought it, and I ended up getting a Greyhound bus ticket, a 30-day ticket from Houston to Boston. And I ended up knocking on the doors of the majority of the artists that were on this list. A couple said no, the majority said yes. And of course, that kind of gave me a working knowledge and relationship. Of course, I didn't realize that this particular point in time, that this was setting the foundation for a longer career. But now I had a face-to-face working relationship with probably the cream of the crop of the African-American art world at this particular point in history.
What a gift for you. I mean, what an opportunity.
No doubt.
Just handed to you. But you were smart enough to say, sure, I can do it. And you also figured out a way to make tracks and actually meet all these people.
Correct. And so the collection was put together, and you know, subsequently they had an opening and different things of that in Chicago. So at this point now, I've kind of got a working relationship with Dr. Biggers, but he's not really being handled by any gallery at this particular point in history, and I'm not quite sure why he never really decided to connect himself with any of the galleries, because obviously going through some of John's records and our conversations, in 1951, I believe he had an exhibition at Knobler in New York, and they talked about, they specifically mentioned John Biggers in the newspaper article. Mm-hmm. And of course, in 1950, he won the Neiman Marcus Purchase Award for drawing. The piece was acquired by the Dallas Museum of Fine Art.
Did he ever reflect with you his thoughts or his attitudes about any of this coming through the 50s, or did he not look back when you met him?
He didn't look back. I think his comments, or at least the stories that he shared with me, were simply reflective of the times mm-hmm. that were happening. Very interestingly, very recently, maybe within the last year, I found what is probably John's earliest existing drawing that is known to date.
And what year is that?
1941,
mm-hmm.
and of which he had just entered Hampton, but was not officially enrolled in the art department at that time. So as I had spoken to Mrs. Biggers, she was like, you know, John was kind of doing things in the evenings and drawing. So I do know that John had saw this drawing before he died, and he offered the owner of the drawing anything that he had in exchange for the drawing. Of course, they, at that point, not being very smart, decided that the drawing was probably worth more than a painting or some other things, and that they were going to keep it. I mean, it was in very poor condition, but certainly it represented a very significant memory point for Dr. Biggers.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting content of this particular drawing was a bus with a black person sitting in the very back of the bus in
mm-hmm.
the last row of seats. A man being lynched, a row house with a mother sitting outside taking care of her children. So I think if we look at a very young John Biggers who is just beginning to enter college, obviously he is very aware of the particular elements of the time that he's existing
mm-hmm.
in, people being lynched, the segregation on the buses, but yet and still finding the strength in terms of the family, of the female structure, who throughout his work has become very instrumental in representing the strength and the connectedness of keeping the family together.
Mm-hmm.
So here, even before he's had any formal art training, he's addressing these social images and his particular element of solution, which was the family and the female hierarchy in the family. But so in reflecting John's views of these particular situations, he seemed to have a certain kind of calm about it. Of course, Mrs. McElshan was very instrumental in being part of, I suppose, a search element of such that brought him here to Houston. And I think that she probably provided some elements of insulation for him,
mm-hmm.
even though it's my understanding that in those very early 50s, maybe around 54, 55, that she tried to give the music hall or give the city of Houston a major work by John Biggers that would have become a public art piece, and it was, of course, refused because of his race. Subsequently, now one of his major murals hangs in Wortham,
mm-hmm.
and I think and it came from the music hall, the old music
right.
hall, but I think part of that was, in fact, influenced by that early denial of the city to accept the work by Dr. Biggers.
Well, as you progressed, coming here and sort of falling into the art trade, the art business, and then crossing paths with Dr. John Biggers, and over the years becoming, I mean, very involved in his work, I would say, right?
Yeah.
Selling mm-hmm. it, looking at it, talking to him, and whatever. How would you characterize his collectors?
I would characterize them as actually gender sensitive, even though there were male collectors. I think that a lot of John's early collectors were females.
Hmm.
And he would tell me about how certain women would come over kind of after it got dark when they couldn't be seen, and they would identify pieces that they wanted to purchase, and that they would get them and kind of leave and, you know, be not seen. But,
and they didn't want to be seen because they didn't want to be seen going into his studio or whatever.
Right. I would imagine.
Probably.
But personality-wise, I suppose, like a lot of other very early, early art collectors in terms of, you know, representing that niche market of being somewhat privileged and educated, and, you know, and certainly being aware of their aesthetics and just acquiring things that touch them. I think for a large portion, for whatever the reason, I think a lot of his early purchasers were Jewish, but one of my thoughts about that process is because Victor Lowenfeld, who was a very, very prominent among the people who were a student, you know, German Expressionism and those mm-hmm. particular areas, he had imparted to John a certain technique and a certain understanding of how to convey his imagery, but using those techniques that that particular class of people were sensitive to.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, hatch marks, the ability to mix paint and produce certain different layers and techniques, though very subliminal kinds of concepts, are things that I think constantly came through. And as a result, I think that a lot of his collectors, a lot of the Jewish collectors, saw those similarities and as a result were attracted to the work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
who are the other artists that you have worked with?
Well,
particularly here in Houston.
Yeah, particularly here in Houston. It became probably more the Lawndale group, which was Bert Long and Jesse Lott. And of course, there was Dave Folkman, who was a major lithographer, had a press called Little Egypt, which represented an area in Carbondale, which just happened to have been the place where I went to undergrad school. But there he did lithographs for Bert Long and Anastasia Sams, whose father was one of the mayors at Prairie View. Of course, there was my involvement with Kermit Oliver. And
now, how did you cross paths with Kermit?
Well, Kermit obviously had been a student of Dr. Biggers, and since what I was doing at that particular point in history was also selling a lot of posters that were reflecting the works of the major artists that were being handled by galleries, I would find myself going into a lot of the galleries in town, purchasing their posters and reselling them into different markets. DuBose Gallery, at that particular point in history, had done, I think, a major American show, and Romare Beard and Larry Rivers and some of the other names of mm-hmm. that statue were in that particular show. But that was the gallery that was handling Kermit at that particular point in history. And subsequently, I guess my first opportunity in terms of doing some type of economic exchange was that Kermit had gotten the commission for the Houston Festival. I'm not sure what it used to be. I think it used to be called the Main Street Festival. And so Kermit did this wonderful rendition of a child standing on top of a bull when the bull had wheels. And it was a delightful poster that I just really kind of got wrapped around. But also probably very important in that whole movement, there was Vivian Ayers. And Vivian, who is the mother of Debbie Allen,
mm-hmm.
they had a museum here called ADEPT, A-D-E-P-T, the ADEPT Cultural Center. And it was over on Ben's, right across the street now from where the Children's Museum is or where they have offices. and she had identified a few of the Houston artists continuing on, but Fletcher Mackey, Toy Sanderson.
Well, how did Houston impress you as a young man coming into the city in the mid-70s, which is kind of at the tail end of our look back? But how did it feel to you?
It felt very rural.
Very rural.
Very, very much.
And this is in the mid-70s.
This is in the mid-70s. Oh, I can tell you. I mean, I remember that day very vividly, getting off the airport at Intercontinental and picking up my rental car. And it seemed like I must have gotten to North Main before I actually saw anything. I mean, there were cow pastures. I mean, all that.
Billboards. You saw a few billboards.
Billboards, yeah. There were a lot of cow pastures.
Yeah.
A lot of cow pastures between here and downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I swung around downtown, which with its couple of little tall buildings, and got off at Scott Street, there the guys who for a long time still continued to play dominoes up under that big shady oak tree. And so I go on down Scott Street and the little shanty type houses, but the businesses were thriving, but it reminded me very much of the small town where that was the town where my grandmother was. And so then I kept the right and swung over to Texas Southern, and it was incredibly hot that day. I mean, it was like in the summer, it must have been 100 degrees, and heat's coming up out of the sidewalk.
You thought, well, where am I?
It's exactly how I felt.
What am I doing here?
Oh, gosh. And as a matter of fact, I think I never told Ron, was when I got to the program, when I went down to meet Ron, he looked and said, "Well, young man," he says, "your GMAT is not quite where we wanted for this accreditation that we're looking for." And I'm like, "I got this letter that says I'm accepted, and I'm down here, and you're trying to tell me that I can't get in school here?" And so there was just kind of a sensibility that just wasn't kind of correct with me in terms of me being at an all-black institution, and first person that tells me that I can't get into school is the new white chair of the MBA program. And I just kind of decided at that moment that I was going to stick around and make a point.
And but you and Ron Bearden became very, very fine friends.
Very fine friends. As a matter of fact, I remember Ron because I entered school on a probationary level, taking three courses, and I remember being in the Galleria that Christmas and running into Ron, and he said, "Oh, you did? You know, you're in the program now." And it kind of went on from there.
Well, in addition to your, from the art standpoint, of course, because then you ended up getting your master's in business, correct?
Correct.
And then, but in addition to you're very fine, and many, many memories of John Biggers. And you worked with Kermit.
I didn't work with Kermit, but
you knew Kermit and some of the. What sticks out in your mind about some of the others?
Well, the excitement and enthusiasm that they brought to the table as artists, and kind of demanding that their work be recognized, and that they were going to make a living as artists. Because I was a business major, so for me it had been product to market and some kind of exchange. But in terms of getting involved with these individuals, I became knowledgeable of the concept, I think, of what an artist is in terms of their abilities, number one, to be able to convey their soul into this two-dimensional or three-dimensional kind of element, and have people react to it. And the second part was that this was a group of individuals that, irrespective of if they were going to sell one piece of art, they still had to get up and create something.
Mm-hmm.
And that would become kind of like my basis of kind of differentiating between the commercial aspect of one element of the art world. Because, I mean, I was involved with situations like Leroy Neiman and, you know, a number of other Peter Maxes, because as I started to go up to New York and work the art fairs, these were obviously names and people that were selling quite a bit. But those are the kinds of things that stand out. Jesse Lott and Bert Long started a newspaper called Art Scene that ended up having some elements of national distribution. And of course, there's Charles Kreiner, who was John's number one student in lithography, and who was a noted printmaker and was showing at the Kaufman Galleries in the early
mm-hmm.
70s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what some of the things that I remember, those particular artists and those particular people of that particular time.
So it's been a really enriching experience for your life, hasn't it?
I would have to say yes.
I think so. You know, at the levels you're talking about an artist getting up in the morning and making art.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it sells or, I mean, there's lessons for all of us coming from those artists just by the fact they come on Earth and they're going to gift us with their insight, translated through their skills and their perceptions. So it's a wonderful stream to swim in.
The artists are very, very, very special people, and the world would certainly be a very poor place if it were not for them.
Discussions about Dr. Biggers, are there any other additional thoughts that you would want to share with us?
Well, I suppose two things that kind of come to mind is that John's PhD was actually formulated from the mural that he created over at the Blue Triangle YWCA, the contribution of Negro women and history to American life and education, is the basis of his PhD doctoral thesis. And certainly, I suppose that's 53 that we're looking at. And the fact that I suppose 4 years later, John received a UNESCO fellowship, which would allow him to travel outside of the country to pursue artistic enrichment. And John made the decision, I suppose, I'm not sure of the parameters of the fellowship, but my kind of understanding is he could have probably gone anywhere in the world to partake of a further artistic education. But John chose to go to Africa, and certainly this was still a point in history where a lot of the artists, Mecca, so to speak, was probably considered Paris,
mm-hmm, okay,
certainly Europe. But John went to Africa, and from that, the book Anansi became a reality, which was a record of the drawings that John did during his 2 year stay over there. After that, there's a really remarkable change that happens in his work, as now he starts to integrate a lot of symbols and patterns into the work, along with other realistic depictions. And I suppose, having spoken to him over the years, now he starts to relate different things and concepts that might kind of represent themselves in terminologies like sacred geometry. And if you look at a lot of the shotgun houses that John did, if you notice the repetitive triangles that are used to create the very tops of these houses, and if you put them into a pattern, so to speak, they become representative of almost like a mosaic type quilt. And it's the same type of imagery that women were doing throughout the South in terms of creating the quilt patterns. The elements of shotgun houses were actually a carryover from Africa to America of them holding on to their architectural knowledge. And all of these things became elements that Dr. Biggers integrated into his work, both very poignantly and visual, and also in a subliminal kind of concept to use as a teaching tool. With John, I think, as well as certainly being a first-rate artist, always looked at himself as an educator and a teacher. I suppose it's very interesting, as I kind of look back, you kind of wonder, as it seems that Texas art in terms of an African-American aesthetic kind of starts with John Biggers, but obviously there were other instructors and teachers and artists that were certainly plying their trade and their craft. And it's very interesting that these are names that really don't come to light. Now, I know that in the 60s there was a group called OBA, Organization of Black Artists, that I think existed through the late 70s. I'm not quite sure. I think one of the high school instructors, Alfred Blair, was the creator of that particular group. He has since passed, and I'm not quite sure what happened to the group after that. But so it just really seems that there is a big missing piece to the puzzle in terms of some of the names and personalities that certainly had to have contributed to John's energy, because artists seem to exist often as a community.
Very much.
And
yeah.
And though I suppose Vito and the early instructors that were at Texas Southern may have represented one element of that artistic family, I'm sure that there is a whole nother component in terms of Houston at large that some very smart interviewer, chronicler of history, will uncover.
Let me ask you, you mentioned the book of
Anansi.
Now tell us where this comes from.
Anansi is a African term for a spider, which was part of African folklore and mythology. And so I'm thinking that that's why John took that particular name. The book was published by University of Texas Press, 1962, if I'm not mistaken, and subsequently reprinted. They did a second edition run, perhaps back in the 90s.
Do you know where he went in Africa?
Yes, I do. Ghana.
Ghana.
Yeah, Ghana. And Accra was the primary focus of his travels. I know that shortly after that book, in the mid-60s, John ended up as a visiting professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where he probably produced his one and only silkscreen. There was a very noted silkscreen artist from there. Him and John were communicating, and I know John used to share with me. He would say, I'm a printmaker, I'm a lithographer, but he said that silkscreen is just too much work. And I don't think I don't think he ever produced another one until in recent years, when he kind of worked in collaboration with some printmakers. And I suppose one other book that became very important in terms of identifying an element of the African-American art community was black art in Houston. And of course, that book was really more representing the content of what was going on in Texas Southern, and it almost really became a catalog of Biggers and Professor Sims
mm-hmm.
in terms of kind of reflecting their philosophies and teaching elements. Of course, there was one other artist that came that John was very influential in bringing into that fold, which was Joe Mack. And Joe Mack ended up taking on the professorship at Prairie View
mm-hmm.
and was there for a number of years. One interesting story that I remember, and I'm not sure where the politics were with that particular element or that particular story, but Joe Mack had left Prairie View and was here in Houston. They lived right around the corner from the Biggers. And Joe Mack had received a call from an element of the current administration at Texas Southern and was offered a very interesting amount of money along with tenure to come into the university, and they were going to be in the process of expanding their buildings. And one of the elements that was going to be covered over were the murals that had been produced, because Dr. Biggers would demand that every graduating student create a mural somewhere mm-hmm. on one of the walls. And Joe looked at the guy and said, well, let me get back to you. And not knowing of the relationship that he and Dr. Biggers had when they made him this offer, because Dr. Biggers was responsible for Joe coming here in 1950. And he went and told him. And as a matter of fact, when they were doing one of the computer rooms, it was they actually did destroy one of the murals, and they ran over and got Dr. Biggers, and he was able to stop it, and so that only that one mural was destroyed. But I think it just simply reflected
an ignorance
and non-sensitivity to a very significant treasure.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, today, I think that there is a real kind of danger in terms of a generation growing up and not being conscious and aware of Dr. Biggers' contributions. I find that the younger students in other cities in other parts of the country probably know more about Dr. Biggers than actually here. The Getty came, and of course they put John in their educational website, which goes out to all the elementary school teachers in America. But there just doesn't seem to be a sense of recognizing what a great treasure and a very significant, how significant his impact was in terms of the art world in general, not only just, simply on the African-American thing. So, I don't know, hopefully there will be some things that will enshrine him into a world that's a little bigger than just that little niche of, collectors and people who are very conscious of the art world.
Well, one thing, this recollection project will probably bring some new people to circle around the fire, and several of the artists that I have interviewed have very caring and very thoughtful recollections about how John Biggers impacted their life and made a difference in in their schooling and in making sure that they had opportunity. So this little project will be a little bit of a stir up. We'll have to wait and see.
Okay, no doubt.